Welcome to the Leap Health in the Workplace podcast. Leap Health empowers individuals and organisations to improve both their physical and mental health. In this podcast, we explore innovative, bespoke, proven health solutions that will improve both your personal and professional productivity and happiness. I'm Anna Redde. Let's get ready to make small steps to Leap Health. So welcome to the podcast today, and this is a really, really interesting topic that I am hugely passionate about, and our guest is too, all around overtraining and how can we find the optimal way to train as women and as men as well. So today, I'm very, very excited. I'm joined by Women's Health UK Fitness Director Bridie Wilkins. Bridie has been in fitness journalism for 8 years, and is also a qualified yoga instructor. She's extremely passionate about the benefits of exercise for both your mental and physical health, and has also built up an unwavering knowledge base after experiencing firsthand how detrimental misinformation can be, so that she can share the hard facts as clearly as she can within her role at Women's Health. She's gone from someone who loved exercise so much but was so misguided that overtraining led to a pelvic stress fracture, leaving her unable to exercise for 11 months, to someone who now spends just as much time and effort on a training as she does on a training recovery as she does actually working out. She tells me exercise has completely changed her life and she couldn't live a day without it. And she feels hugely privileged every day to be able to spend her working days helping others on the same path. So, good morning, Bridie.
Hi, thank you so much. What a lovely intro.
It's really, really wonderful to have you on the podcast, and we welcome you here today. This is a topic that I think we both got quite excited and passionate about when we had a discussion a little while ago. Now, we explored lots of different topics that we could talk about on this podcast, but it was one that I think resonated with both of us, and we both really wanted to create a little bit more understanding around it, awareness, and empower people to be able to avoid the pitfalls of overtraining. So I've given you a little bit of an introduction there, Bridie, but is there anything I've missed out, anything that you'd like to tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, I guess I can tell you a little bit about how I got into Women's Health. So I've been fitness director. I was recently promoted, actually, but to work at Women's Health, thank you. To work at Women's Health was my dream job for years. I think I actually applied to, this was the fourth role I'd applied for until I actually got hired. And I've been there for almost 2 years now, but I've been into fitness since uni, which was nearly 10 years ago. Terrifying, literally terrifying. And it was during my time at uni that I started to obviously unknowingly overtrain just because I was so uneducated. And I think the narrative around exercise back then was really different to what it is now, or at least that's how I interpreted it at that age. So I would take a lot of inspiration from things that I saw on social media, and obviously the lines between personal experiences, opinions, and hard facts on social are very blurred, probably more so back then than they are now. So even though I exercised purely for my mental health and to manage my stress during uni, it just became a bit of a vicious cycle, because obviously the more stressed I became, the more I exercised without realizing that that was obviously harming my body and making me more stressed. And that was what ended up with me sustaining a pelvic stress fracture, which, like you said, wasn't diagnosed for a year. And during that time, I could barely exercise at all. I was even advised not to walk if I could help it. So naturally, I just became incredibly depressed. And that has definitely influenced how passionate I feel about just educating women about overtraining now. I absolutely love my job. And I just feel so privileged that I get to talk to some of the most experienced and well-renowned experts in the field and to share that with other people.
Thank you, Bridie. And I think lots of people listening to this now would think, yeah, that is an amazing job to be in the position that you're in, where you can really influence and empower so many people with the correct incredible information. So thank you. You have made me feel rather old there, though, Bridie, saying that it was 20 years ago since you went to university. I just did the maths there, and it's 23 years ago since I started uni. So, yep, I am feeling rather old. But even back then, I think the way I trained at uni, I would never train like that now, because I didn't have the information. I wasn't empowered to overcome those pitfalls that you can experience about overtraining. And as you said, often people do this for the mental health, because it is a huge enabler for your mental health is exercise, but taking it too far can also lead to consequences and detrimental effects on your mental health. So thank you for that. So let's just start off by defining, you know, we've named this podcast overtraining, but what exactly is overtraining? Let's just identify what it is.
Yeah, sure. So I just want to caveat, obviously, you mentioned that I'm a yoga instructor, but I'm not a qualified personal trainer or a doctor. But I have obviously interviewed probably near on hundreds of experts on this topic. So overtraining occurs when a person exceeds their body's ability to recover from strenuous exercise. So symptoms from that might be that you hit a plateau or you start to see a decrease in your exercise performance. But I think where a lot of women go wrong is that they think their symptoms need to be really severe. Like obviously my pelvic stress fracture was, but it doesn't need to be for you to be classified as someone that is overtraining. It might literally just be that you feel more fatigued than normal. And that could be the sign that you need to let you know that you need to let up on how often or how intensely you're training. And that doesn't actually mean to be, need to be physically fatiguing. It could be that you feel mentally tired. So you might find that you're struggling to concentrate at work. You might not be enjoying social situations, things like that.
Thank you. Yeah, and those are some of the things that maybe we don't just always relate to overtraining, because we always think the more the better. But like you said, you know, it might be impacting you on those social situations, on your concentration. And it's finding that balance, that individual balance, isn't it? Because we use exercise, you know, exercise increases your BDNF, which increases your creativity, your concentration. But then it can have negative effects if you overstep that mark. So it's about finding that individual balance, totally. So the NHS currently recommend that we get 150 minutes of moderate exercise a week, 75 minutes of vigorous exercise a week. The general message is the more the better. And, you know, if you Google exercise, that is the general message that comes up, the more the better. Can you maybe delve a little bit deeper? I know you've touched on this, but in terms of certain situations when more the better is not really the case.
100%. Yeah, I feel really passionately about that one. So as I was saying, my first experience with overtraining came because I believed that if I was training for my mental health benefits, how could I possibly be doing too much? Which kind of ties in with what you were just saying. Whereas in reality, studies have actually shown that exercise can exacerbate existing mental health problems. And when I say mental health problems, I don't necessarily mean diagnosed conditions like depression, etc. It could just be, like I was saying, at the time I felt extremely stressed. So through overtraining, because you're constantly trying to sustain this overwhelming routine, that can just add to the stress that you're already feeling, which then defeats the point of exercising in the first place. I feel like we're constantly told that exercise is so great for us, and obviously it is, but we do often do too much, which then negates the benefits and more, like becomes even more detrimental. All that said, I do think it very much depends on the type of exercise that you're doing. So you might be fine with doing a daily workout if those workouts are, say, 10 to 20 minutes long and they're only moderately intense. So for example, at the moment, I'm doing a Pilates challenge where I'm reviewing a particular app and I'm doing the workouts every day. Before that, I would never do daily workouts. Even when I sustained the pelvic stress fracture and I was overtraining, etc., I was actually only doing about between 3 and 5K runs about 3 or 4 times a week. So I thought that doing this Pilates challenge and doing daily workouts would be basically impossible, or I'd just feel totally exhausted. But obviously, all in the name of journalism, I thought I'd do it. But because the workouts are so short and they're low intensity, I have honestly been so surprised by how much better I felt, and I'm genuinely loving it. And because obviously, like, the mental health benefits that come from exercising, like the energy boost it gives you, it makes you concentrate better. It puts you in just a complete different mindset. Because I'm getting that every day rather than just the 3 or 4 times a week that I've previously been doing, it's just been so much better for me. But I know that if those workouts were longer and they were more intense, I wouldn't feel that way. I think it just really boils down to finding a workout type that suits you and not overdoing it. Because even if you are doing something like, for example, Pilates, it might be a moderately intense workout. But if you do that for, not that anyone would do this, but if you're doing that for 2 hours a day, obviously that's going to have negative effects.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think I can really appreciate that breaking it down into smaller chunks as well. And because we alluded to earlier on, if you get into the circle of having to do more and more all the time, that becomes a stress in your mind, doesn't it? You know, you're constantly thinking, when am I going to be training again? When am I going to be training again? Whereas if it's just broken down into manageable things that you can fit into your daily life, you can actually enjoy it. You can look forward to it because it's not causing a stress thinking, oh, I haven't got time to do this and I've got to fit it in to get my fix. So yeah, and I'm totally with you. I've changed my training after years and years, and now half an hour fix in the morning to do a little YouTube workout gives me that boost of energy every day, but leaves you feeling mentally stronger as well.
Yeah, 100%. Just to go back to what you were saying about it being a stress in your mind and you just constantly thinking that you need to do that workout. That was me when I told myself that if I didn't do those workouts, I was going to feel more stressed. But then in the back of my mind, I'd be thinking, oh my God, I need to do the workout. I'd cancel social plans. It never got in the way of uni work, as in lectures, etc. But I'd cancel social plans. We can come on to this a bit later, but I wasn't sleeping much because I'd rather get up and work out when obviously sleep is so important. So yeah, I think it just defeats the point of exercising if it becomes a stress.
Totally. And yeah, I think we're going to delve into this a little bit more shortly. But I'll just ask our listeners a question really now. Do you ever prioritise your workout before your sleep? You know, do you ever set your alarm super early to go to the gym, which means that all night you're actually thinking, oh, can't sleep because I know my alarm's going to go off and I've got to go to the gym. And if you do, maybe I'd invest a little bit of time looking about the importance of your sleep, because you know, getting that in order can have huge benefits for the outcomes of the exercise that you do, and you probably have to do less to get more benefit if your sleep's in order. But we'll save that. We'll pause that thought for a little bit later. So thinking about those short-term and long-term consequences, I know that you've spoken a little bit about what they might present like. What kind of evidence is there out there around what are the short-term consequences, what are the long-term consequences, and what can you add to what we've already spoken about?
They can be short-term and long-term. The first one is fatigue. Obviously, slightly touched on that already. For me, apart from my pelvic stress fracture, fatigue was the biggest sign, and it usually is. Studies have shown that it usually is the first sign of overtraining to occur. But as I've mentioned, that doesn't necessarily need to be physical fatigue. It can be mental, so things like concentration, just your general mood, which then ties into the next consequence, which is mental health. So again, obviously mentioned that although exercise is sort of touted as this almost cure-all for stress and anxiety, studies have shown that overtraining can add to any stress you're feeling because you're trying to sustain such an unachievable routine. And then other studies have also shown that overtraining can mean that you spend more time in fight or flight mode, which means that your sympathetic nervous system is constantly activated. So basically, you're just constantly in a high stress mode. And then if you add to that the increase in cortisol that comes from overtraining, that can then have an effect on your sleep, which then can obviously affect your mental health and can increase the likelihood of things like feeling depressed or anxious, just general stress. So that is a huge one. Another one, effects on your menstrual cycle. So overtraining can cause something called REDF, which stands for relative energy deficiency in sport. And that occurs when your body doesn't have enough energy to regulate and produce the reproductive hormones needed for your periods. So you don't have a monthly period. And these hormones, particularly estrogen, are also really important for your bone and cognitive health. And long-term overtraining can have a really big impact on both of those. So in the long term, poor bone health can lead to something called osteoporosis, which is when your bone mineral density and your bone mass both decrease, which means you're more prone to fractures and broken bones. So I, when I had my pelvic stress fracture, I was, after a very long time, eventually diagnosed with osteopenia, which is basically the predecessor to osteoporosis. So it's not quite as bad, but still quite bad. And they were just so shocked because I think I was around, I was about 21 when I had the stress fracture. And it was just so unheard of for someone of my age and who obviously on the surface looked so fit and did exercise, but not necessarily a wild amount. Like I said, it was only 3 or 4 runs a week. So yeah, that is definitely a big one. And then in terms of your menstrual cycle, obviously if you go too long without a period, that can have an effect on your fertility in the long term. And then another one, which I don't think as many people are as aware of, but it does make a lot of sense, is if you overtrain too much, your immune system becomes compromised. Studies have shown that overtraining can cause decreased levels of antibodies, which are basically the things that fight off colds and flus and viruses, etc. So if you've got fewer antibodies, you're going to become more susceptible to illness. So again, you think that exercise is great, it's going to make you healthier, make you fitter, stronger, more able to fight off illnesses. But actually, if you do too much, it's going to do the opposite.
Interesting, interesting. And really, on the contrary to what the message is always, as you said, more exercise. And yet we've highlighted, or Brady's highlighted there, so many consequences of not getting that balance right. And you know, there's a few points there that I really heard you say that I think I'd like to just explore a little bit more. Red, so relative energy deficiency in sport. This is probably far more prevalent than we actually realise. And in a sporting, professional sporting performance, I think we've got to appreciate all the support that athletes get. So they have people who optimise their nutrition. That, you know, you hear of lots of athletes, like Mo Farah, I've heard him talking about his regime. He sleeps in the afternoon. They prioritise the rest and the recovery as well. They've got experts on hand all the time to be watching how they're actually recovering and how they're actually refueling. And there's an area, isn't there? It's probably growing now because more and more people are into exercise, but there's a bigger cohort of people now that are exercising at a high intensity level, but without that professional support and guidance as well to accompany it. And that's where REDS can be really, really prevalent. And yeah, picking up on point about osteopenia, you know, it doesn't always present with a fracture. It could still be going on. It's not always symptomatic. It can be asymptomatic. I myself also was diagnosed with osteopenia quite a few years ago, which really was a rude awakening and encouraged me to make lifestyle interventions. Osteopenia, to add to that, it can be reversible. Osteoporosis is not reversible. Osteopenia is that warning sign. And as Bradley said, the precursor to osteoporosis. So you can make lifestyle interventions and you'll be taking supplements to reverse that osteopenia. So really encourage you, if you do think that you are overtraining and have been doing for a long time, try and contact your healthcare professional, try and get a PET scan just to identify what's going on in your body, and that could be a real driver in you making a positive change to get a good balance.
What you were saying about it being reversible, that's actually a really good point. I obviously, like you've just said that you did, made big lifestyle changes. So I implemented a lot more weight training, because weight training has been shown that the stress that you put on your bones activates something called osteoblasts, which is what produces and promotes the production of bone mass. So I've done a lot more of that. And then in January of this year, I was lucky enough to go to a retreat in Switzerland, because obviously DEXA scans, you can't just walk into a doctor surgery or a hospital and ask for a DEXA scan, you need to have a reason. But I went to this retreat in Switzerland and was lucky enough to get a DEXA scan there, and it showed that I no longer show signs of osteopenia, which was great. So it is definitely proof that you can reverse it, and reassuring to know for anyone who might think that they are suffering or know that they're suffering.
Certainly, and that is, you know, a huge motivation to realize and realization of how training, changing your training to an optimal way, has a wonderful response in your body, and your body can repair yourself. And those osteoblasts are the ones that create more bone density. Up to about the age of 30, 35, the osteoblasts are in full force more than the osteoclasts, and the osteoclasts are what deteriorate your bones. So after about that age of 30, 35, that's when we really, really need to be making sure that we are doing lots of things to maintain the osteoblast activity, such as you said, Brad, and again, this was a huge game changer for me, strength training. Strength training, a really, really, really positive thing. And Brady just alluded there to her retreat. Anyone listening, I would encourage checking out Brady on social media. She goes all over the place trying out amazing, wonderful, interesting things. And maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that shortly. Sure. So I think we've kind of touched on different components to that imbalance of energy when overtraining. But is there anything else that you'd like to go a bit deeper on in terms of the nutrition, rest and recovery, and any other elements that could affect the imbalance of that exercise?
Definitely, yeah. So obviously when you overtrain, your body uses more energy for exercise, and it becomes deficient in the energy that you need for other necessary functions, things like I've said, producing the hormones that are needed for your menstrual cycle, producing antibodies to fight off illness and infection. But like you've just said, Anna, overtraining isn't the only factor that can bring on that energy deficiency. So for me, again, I've said this already, but I didn't think I was overtraining, and technically I wasn't, because I was only doing 3 or 4 runs a week, but my nutrition was non-existent. I was at uni, basically living on pasta and cereal. And I didn't even consider the importance of rest and recovery. That wasn't even a thing for me. I was going out probably 4 or 5 times a week. My sleep was, I can't even imagine how little I was getting. Now I'm like a 9-hour a night girl, but back then it was probably like 5 hours, potentially less. But both of those things, nutrition and rest, play a huge part in energy balance. It is just a balancing act. So like the more you train, the more you're going to need to eat and rest. But if you do have a week where you train less, you might naturally feel less hungry and therefore eat less. But that said, obviously, your nutrition should always be balanced. You want to include every macronutrient. You want to eat as many fruit and vegetables as you can. And then I think it's also important to think about what rest actually means. So obviously, having a day off of exercise is a no-brainer. But how else can you enhance your recovery? So things like Epsom salt baths or using a massage gun. I'm not sure how many of your listeners will be willing to invest as much money as this, but I was gifted this to review it for the Women's Health website if you're interested in reading it. But I have a pair of compression boots by Therabody, and they are brilliant. I literally swear by them. How they work is you pull them on like a pair of boots almost, but they come up to your hips, and then they compress your muscles so the blood flow is restricted, and then when they deflate, new blood flow rushes in and saturates your cells with all the sort of nutrients and everything that they need to recover. And honestly, if I've got DOMS in my legs, or my legs just feel a bit sore or tired, I'll use those compression boots for half an hour, and they honestly feel completely different. like so much lighter. It's great.
Wow. I have seen you post on Instagram actually where you've got those on. Yeah, they look great. yeah, I was thinking about what are the other stresses that are going on in your life, I guess, as well.
100%, yeah.
If you're maybe you've got a stressful job or you're caring for the people, you've got children, you've got elderly relatives that you care for, you've got pets as well that you can add that extra stresses on your life. Even if you're having a rest day, which I think well, this is the day off the gym, think about the other stresses that go on in your life and how can you put small interventions into place to try and minimize those stresses and just generally be kind to yourself, nurture yourself and nourish yourself and be kind to yourself. And in terms of that, you mentioned that energy balance with fueling, so important to be fueling, right? And over the past, we've had crazes such as fat free, so lots of people were missing out those essential fats, are certain ones which are critical for your hormonal health, and you can be missing out certain vitamins and minerals that you need as well. And I do love how you said, I'm with you there, Ryder, in terms of don't be missing out food groups. Macro means big, it means important. So missing out important things can potentially leave you deficient. And having said that, we're not healthcare professionals, but there are certain situations when you might be leaving out macros. One example is in terms of the ketogenic diet, there is data in epilepsy patients, more emerging data, not as much in diabetes, but that's where it all stemmed from. But yeah, key message, macro, big, don't leave it out.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry,
One
Brady,
thing.
I'm talking too much in your space to talk. You go for it.
It's fine. I was just going to say on the topic of nutrition, I've never really spoken about this, but during my sort of recovery with the stress fracture and trying to take stock of my nutrition, et cetera, I ended up going too far the other way. It was never diagnosed, but I was sort of on the brink of orthorexia, which is basically where you become almost too obsessed with eating healthily. So you think that you're getting everything that you want, but then you're also missing out on just a balance, really, which then again just adds to the stress. Like I was almost scared to eat anything that was processed or just anything that was deemed bad for you. And again, a lot of that stemmed from social media. But yeah, I just think it's so important for people to realize that nothing is bad for you if it's in a balance.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's all about nourishing your body. And yeah, I can resonate with you there as well. There's so many messages about you must do this, you must do that. And if you're getting so fixated on those things, that's probably causing you a stress as well. So on that topic, which is a nice link onto my next question, how can we actually stick to, in a world now where we've so much exposure to social media, it's a while since we went to uni maybe, but those that are, well, significantly younger than me, slightly younger than you, Bridie, quite vulnerable being exposed to all this random information from YouTubers. I've got a wonderful example of Prime, how my kids think it's the best thing ever, and it's basically because of the influencer. But how can we actually sift through all this mind-boggling information to identify credible sources and actually cherry-pick the information that's relevant for us?
So I don't know if you saw, but earlier this year, not that long ago actually, YouTube announced that they're going to be verifying NHS workers with a tick, a bit like the blue tick on
Yes,
Instagram.
I did see this, yes.
Yeah, so good. And in our ideal world, I think Instagram should be doing the same and verifying not just NHS workers, but all health professionals with a different coloured tick to the blue tick, obviously. But for now, I think the best advice is just to read the bio of the person that you're taking information from, because if they're qualified, chances are that they're going to have said so in their bio, and then you'll know that the information that they're sharing is valid and it's not just unsolicited random advice. So at Women's Health, it's pretty much a prerequisite that with every article, we use qualified experts as sources to back up whatever it is that we're writing about. And then our job is to obviously share that information in a format that means our readers can understand and action that within their own lives. I feel like social media is often quite vilified, but I do think that if you make even just the tiniest of changes. So for example, I just did a cull of all the sort of random influencers who aren't actually qualified to make the claims that they were. I just unfollowed them. And if you do make changes like that, I think it can be a really useful space, and it can give people a voice that wouldn't have necessarily had one before, and teach you a lot. Like I, for one, when it comes to writing articles for Women's Health, I get probably 70% of my ideas from social media, just seeing what people are interested in, seeing what the experts are talking about, seeing what's coming up for them, what they're seeing with their clients. The same with when I say experts, I don't just mean doctors, nutritionists. I mean personal trainers, physicians, physiologists, strength and conditioning coaches, anyone in that field. So yeah, I don't think social media is that bad, as long as you tailor it to suit what you want to use it for.
Yeah, tailor it to suit what you need it for. Was that your phrase?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I love that. And I think that's what it's about. As I said, you're cherry picking and tailoring it to your individual world. And yeah, it's not a bad place, but we just need to be wise as to how we make sure we use credible sources. So yeah, really positive that healthcare professionals will be highlighted on there as well. Look at bios. It's worrying in some ways, but a real enabler in other ways. And my background was in pharmaceuticals for over 18 years. And the regulation there in terms of what we were allowed to say from studies and what we weren't allowed compared to what's available on social media now is worlds apart. But yeah. As you said, you can learn so much from so many different lenses as well. As you've highlighted all different professionals there that you can get sort of a variety and abundance of quality information from as well. So just be wise to make sure that you are getting credible.
I also think Instagram does listen to you. Obviously, it's not going to tell you. I mean, like I've said, you can read people's bios, but Instagram won't explicitly tell you whether someone's an expert or not before you click on the post. But if your interests are all fitness, so for example, because obviously everyone that I follow is into health or fitness, or everything that I like or save or share, etc., is about fitness or health. Now the algorithm obviously just sends me everything that's health or fitness related, which is essentially useful because it saves me the time having to like dig deep and try and find this information. They literally hand it to you on a plate, but then it's just up to you to, it doesn't take long, literally just look at their feed and check their bio. And if it doesn't say that they're qualified, I would just do your best not to try and take information from them, really.
Absolutely. And as you said, you will come up with the feeds that you're looking at. So those experts that you have chosen to follow are the ones that you will see first.
Yeah, I was just saying, yeah, exactly. And then as well as just your feed on the Discover page, that's where you'll get sent more and more experts. You just get more and more all the time, which is great.
Thank you. I don't know if I've gone on Discover page. I'm not an expert on Instagram.
I think it's called Discover. It's the second icon at the bottom next to the homepage, which is where you see all of the content from your actual people that you follow.
Super. Bit of homework there for me. I've written so in terms of solutions that people can take away with, delved into what overtraining is, what the consequences are, what can be causing it, what would you say are some of the practical solutions that listeners can start implementing today?
Yeah, sure. So again, I just want to say I'm not a personal trainer, but based on the experts that I've spoken to over the years, both regarding my own experience with overtraining and the articles that I've written, there are some very simple and actionable pieces of advice and things that I've picked up. But before I go into that, it's probably also reassuring for any listeners who might be showing signs of overtraining to know that studies have shown that symptoms of overtraining normally resolve within 6 to 12 weeks once you start to turn things around and train and fuel yourself properly. So for me, once I'd been diagnosed with the stress fracture and they explained everything that was going on, it probably only took me about 8 weeks to feel better, to feel stronger. And that was when So I did about 8 weeks of physio, and then they signed me off to do more exercise. And that, compared to the 11 to 12 months that I went without exercising whatsoever, is obviously a very insignificant amount of time. So I think that's just reassuring to know. In terms of the solutions, the first thing, probably the most obvious, I'd say, is to just reduce the intensity of your workouts. So limit things like HIIT, intense cardio, CrossFit, because all of those trigger a big stress response and put your cortisol levels through the roof, which we already know is going to not be a good thing. So instead, I'd say go for things like strength training. That obviously includes weights, but also Pilates counts, and then walking and yoga. All of those have been proven to reduce your cortisol levels. But as I kind of touched on before, you obviously need to stick to realistic and healthy durations. So once I got signed off to train again, I don't think I did more than 30 minutes for about 2 years. And even now, barely ever do longer than 45 minute workouts. And then obviously fuel. So think about how you're fueling yourself. I wouldn't recommend, just based on everything that I've heard from experts, I wouldn't recommend training without eating. So I've previously interviewed quite a few times someone called Dr. Stacey Sims. She's a very well-known female physiologist. And I spoke to her about the dangers of fasted cardio and fasted training. And we were talking about how it's particularly significant for someone who's recovering from overtraining. Because obviously, if you train without eating, that then sends your cortisol through the roof, which can affect your sleep quality, which can affect your anxiety levels. But also, another study showed that you're less likely to be able to build muscle or strength if you don't eat prior to a workout, because your body uses the lean muscle mass that you have for energy. Whereas obviously, if you've eaten before, it will take the fuel from that. So I now almost always, I'd say 90% of the time, I almost always have at least a banana, but usually I just have a full-on breakfast. I'll have like eggs on toast, avocado on toast, and I just feel completely different. And I think a lot of people think that if you eat before, you're not going to see results for people that are hoping to achieve a certain goal. But that is definitely not true, as that study has shown. And then, sounds obvious, but take rest days, obviously. I know how tempting it can be to give them a miss if you don't feel like you need one. And if you are someone who's showing signs of overtraining, this is kind of how I felt. You're probably so used to feeling a certain way that you might not even be aware that you need a rest day. Like, you're so used to your body feeling tired that that is the norm for you. So now I will take at least 3 rest days a week, and I always schedule them between workout days to give my muscles maximum recovery time. So I'll do a workout on a Monday, rest day Tuesday, workout Wednesday, rest day Thursday. I actually interviewed a case study not that long ago about how she adapted her approach to exercise to bring her periods back again after she'd experienced amenorrhea, which is when you stop having periods. And obviously exercise helped in that she changed the intensity, she changed the durations, but taking regular rest days was one of, if not most, the most important factor in bringing her periods back, which I thought was just very telling. So yeah, I think obviously reducing the intensity, thinking about your fuel, and taking rest days, with those 3 things, you're pretty much on your way back to recovery.
Super, super. And it sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? It does sound really simple. Doing those things and you'll create that balance. But it's just making sure that you keep focusing on those things as much as you're focusing on the exercise, and try and keep it at the forefront of your mind. Yeah, you touched on amenorrhea then. I suffered with amenorrhea for a long, long time. I actually got a book that I started reading about, which just changed the way I thought about things when I started thinking more about the long-term consequences. It's just making sure that you keep drip feeding yourself with the long-term consequences of not getting that correct balance, and create that dissatisfaction that if you don't get that balance, what could potentially happen. Also as well, you're around eating before you train, I'm with you there as well. That can, and there's a lot of hype around intermittent fasting, lots of positive evidence around that as well, but it can play havoc with women's hormones. So really take an individualized approach to that. So yeah, like you said, Breda, do feel like a little bit of food before you train, the right types of food can be really, really an enabler in terms of making you train harder but recover better as well.
Yeah, definitely. I follow someone on Instagram called Dr. Renee McGregor, and she is so knowledgeable, and just so everything she posts about is just so easy to understand. So if you are someone that is experiencing amenorrhea or overtraining and you're just struggling with knowing what to do, she's definitely someone I would recommend following.
I can vouch for her as well. Yes, I followed a lot of her work when exploring more about amenorrhea and overtraining. So definitely back you up on that one. So just slightly deviating a little bit, the world's changed quite a lot in the last few years. Post-COVID, the workplaces have changed. There's a lot more online meetings, people are a little bit more isolated. So maybe the overtraining is not always as easy to detect in other people. Stresses have increased because if you think you're working from home, you also think you can juggle the rest of the world as well. How do you think that's impacted on getting that optimal level of training?
So like you said, I feel like it can be interpreted in two ways. For me, I personally feel like hybrid working, which according to the Office of National Statistics, 40% of workplaces still implement hybrid working. And for me, I feel like that has, sounds so cliche, but it has genuinely changed my life for the better. I feel like it's reduced my stress levels. It's helped me optimize my training. We've got more time at home. We're spending less time commuting, which means we've got more time to think about and stick to a proper workout program. Whereas before, I just felt so exhausted from 5 days in the office that I would only ever train on the weekends. But when you think about it, my body was never really getting a break, because on the 5 office days a week, I'd be racking up like over 10K steps a day, just from like walking to the station, walking to the office, going for a walk at lunch. And then I'd be doing workouts on weekends. And I think a lot of people think that walking doesn't really count as a workout, but it does 100%. I actually feel like sometimes if I've just been in the office, I haven't done a workout, but say I've done like over 10K steps, I'll never do more than, I mean, even 10K for me is like, wow, can't believe I hit that. But if, say if I do anything over 10K, I mean, max, we're talking 13K. I feel more tired than if I've done like a 45 minute workout. So it definitely, definitely takes a toll on your body. But I did read a study this week, actually, that said office days can increase your likeliness to exercise, which kind of makes sense. Because if you think about it, if you're already up and out, you're probably a lot more likely to go to the gym, whereas you probably won't feel as inclined to get up and train in the morning, especially now when it's dark, cold, raining, if you're just going to go straight back home. Even with home workouts, I do think they are still very big since the pandemic. And like a lot of people have learned that they are just as, if not more effective than going to the gym, but might not have as much of an impact. But I do think it kind of depends on the person that you are. If you're going to the office, you might find that then you can go to the gym straight after work. You can go to the gym before. You might have time to go to the gym on lunch. But I personally feel like hybrid working, we do 3 days a week in the office. And to have the 2 days a week at home, even just to catch up and sleep a bit, because my commute is just over an hour each way. So in the morning, I would take the time to sleep for an extra hour, and then I'd have more energy to work out later in the day.
Definitely, we get quite a lot of time back, so it's imperative that we use that time in a productive way to reduce our stress levels.
Yeah, exactly. Although I do feel like there is a lot of pressure on us to be productive, and again, I feel like that sort of adds to the stress. Maybe that the time back that you get from not commuting, you literally just want to use it to read or even watching TV. Like that can be a de-stressor. And I think people think that you need to be productive all the time, but that just makes you feel stressed, which then can sometimes impact your productivity. I feel like it's just such a vicious cycle.
It is. It's a real balancing act, isn't it? And yeah, there was one company that I work with that actually insist on white space, so that their employees take so much white space every week, which is just a time when they're permitted to sit and watch Netflix. They're permitted just to chill out.
I love that.
Actually enables them then to be more productive because they've actually rested the mind. So moving on from that, what solutions do you think workplaces can put into place to support that well-being?
So I definitely think sticking with hybrid working and not increasing it, like if it was to become 5 days a week again, I think that would have a big impact on people's mental health. Something that we do at Women's Health, we try and do a team workout once a month. So this month we did a reformer class at a studio called Cycle in London. The month before that, we did a workout at Gymshark on Oxford Street, which is actually free for everyone. They put on free workouts for everyone, which is great. And I know most workplaces always try and do some sort of team building event. And I think anything active like that, not necessarily even a workout, but just giving employees the option to do something like rock climbing or going to a driving range, probably not one for me, but I know that like my boyfriend would absolutely love that. Just anything that gets people moving. I think using team building time to do something like that is a great thing.
So totally, totally. And it not only just gets people moving, it builds that connection and it builds belonging in teams. And people often talk more than if they sat face to face in an office. This is something I often recommend to people in like the reviews. The traditional way is to either sit, you know, on Zoom or Teams face to face or in an office face to face. When you're wanting to have quite brave confrontational conversations that are going to move things along, people are far more comfortable to do that when they're out in the fresh air or walking side by side. I think you build up that belonging and connection a lot more
100%.
doing those things. Yeah, just to add to that, I think we probably need to be working hybrid a little bit more mindful and challenging as to, does every meeting have to be over Zoom? Does every meeting have to be sat down in the office, and try and get doing as many walk and talks as we possibly can?
I love that. Yeah, I would love, I'm going to suggest that. I love the idea of walking meetings. I think
Maybe we could take it further and do a walking podcast at some point, Brad.
Yeah, I love, have you listened to Dr. Alex George's podcast? I think it's called The Stomp or something. Stomp podcast.
Do you know what? I've got one of his episodes downloaded waiting to listen to. So yeah, maybe.
That's great. I just love the concept.
Yeah, definitely. So we've kind of explored, I think, around the different types of training. You've alluded to HIIT and cardio, how that might increase your cortisol levels more so than Pilates and yoga. Is there anything else you've got to add around different types of training that you would recommend? Obviously, you have got your expertise in yoga, which I don't have any at all. So I'd love to pick your brains around that. But yeah, you go for it, Bradley. What else do you want to add about different types of training?
So just to touch on what you've just said about yoga, I think it's just important to know that what you might like, it's only natural that that's going to change a lot. So I usually do a combination of everything, but there are times when, for example, I can't think of anything worse than doing yoga and it makes me feel more stressed than it does relaxed. And other times I'd much rather do a HIIT workout. And I think it's important to know that mixing it up actually is a really good thing. So I'm currently working on a piece around hybrid training. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but it's become a bit of a trend, and lots of personal trainers and athletes are now actually billing themselves as hybrid athletes. So what that means is it's just a combination of strength training with cardio. And studies have actually shown that doing that can bring about the biggest benefits for your cardio metabolic health. So how healthy your heart is and how efficient your metabolism is. Because obviously you train your heart when you're doing cardio and you build your muscles through strength training, and muscle is more metabolically active than fat. So you burn more calories at rest, which means that your metabolism is more efficient. And that can be, you can either do strength training with cardio within an individual workout, or it can be across like a month's or a week's program. One thing I would say in the context of overtraining is if you are combining all of those things, you're more likely to run the risk of symptoms of overtraining if they are the more intense things. So things like HIIT and CrossFit. I read a study about elite female runners, and it showed that 60% of them suffer with overtraining at least once in their lives. Obviously, their routines are a lot more intense than the average runner and or you and I, but the point that I'm trying to make is the more intense the workout you do, the more energy you're going to use, the more your cortisol is going to spike. And then that's going to have a knock-on effect to the other effects that we've already discussed, the consequences. But I'm not saying you should never do those types of fitness if that's what you enjoy. I think that's the thing that people need to remember. You need to just find a type of workout that you enjoy and that you're going to look forward to. And then as long as you've got a solid rest and recovery routine, so you take regular rest days, you help your body recover with good nutrition, you take enough chill time, you practice mindfulness, so whether that's meditation or, like I said, reading. Reading for me, I absolutely love it. That is my meditation. I will read every single night. My boyfriend thinks I'm wild because I literally go to bed. This is not even an exaggeration. I'm in bed by like 8:30 and then I'll read until like 10. But sometimes I won't finish dinner until like 7:30. And then I'm like, right, I'm off to bed an hour later. I think it's just finding what works for you. So exercise, find what you enjoy. If you dread what you've chosen to do, you're obviously a lot more likely to make excuses, which means you're just going to naturally move your body less. You just want to find something that you look forward to. Then you're going to remain consistent with it. You're going to do it more. You're going to move your body. You're not going to feel stressed about doing it. And the same with mindfulness. I think a lot of people, when you say mindfulness or mindful, the first thing that comes into their head is meditation. And for a lot of people, that's like, whoa, can't do that. Even I practice yoga regularly, but meditation for me, it has to be guided and it has to be like 5 minutes. Anything over 5 minutes and I'm like, oh, like what's going on? Things start coming into my head. And it's just one of those things, isn't it? It's hard to know whether you're doing it right because you can't see what other people, you can't see what's going on in everyone else's minds. So I think you just need to listen to your body. If meditation is something that you're like, absolutely not, try reading, try journaling, try walking. There are so many things that you can do.
Interesting. You put some really good points there. You know, golden nugget, I think, is find what you enjoy and manage your recovery as well with that. What I found quite fascinating as well is that hybrid training isn't a phrase that I've used very often before, but I am actually doing it, so that's encouraging to know that I'm up there with the fashion. And maybe, you know, don't overcomplicate it. You mentioned mindfulness, and I know for a lot of people they're like, whoa, that's a bit way out there, I'm not into that. But you know, it doesn't have to be like really deep. Every night when I'm getting my little boy to sleep, he has a little kid sleep meditation on, and I use that as my relaxation as well. So it can be incorporated without it being a full on, you know, mindful chore that you think you've got to integrate. So yeah, just don't overcomplicate it. So we've explored quite a lot there, Brad. I feel like we've touched on lots and lots of different areas. We've had a few questions sent in. These were requested that were kept anonymous. The first would be, what would be your solutions to calm that voice in my head telling me to train more and more? So for anyone that's read the Steve Peters Chimp Paradox, it's a bit like that chimp in your head that's telling you all the time, come on, you've got to do more. And what would be your recommendations, Brady?
I think just listen to your body. If you feel like you do need to do a workout every day, like I've been saying with the Pilates challenge I've been doing, I'm not saying that it should be Pilates, but if it's a workout that does make you feel good and it's not intense and you're not going to do it for an hour every day, then fine. It might be that you do those 15 minutes of a day and that is all you need. That could completely change your mind. I know, like I said, I'd never done daily workouts before doing this challenge, but even though they were daily, because they were only, I mean, the ones I'd committed to doing were between 10 and 20 minutes long. And in my head, I was like, oh, that's not going to be enough, because you think like the standard workout is like 45 minutes to an hour. So I was like, oh, that's not going to be enough. But honestly, after only about 2 weeks, my mind has completely changed. So I think, yeah, just to come back to the question, if you find something that you can do that's not intense and you can do it for short periods of time every day, that might just sort of scratch that itch that you've got. But just remind yourself, where is that coming from? Is it because you're seeing other people doing workouts every day? I often look at people on Instagram and I think, how are they doing that? But then I remind myself, they're a PT, that's their job. Like, they've filmed that workout and it looks like they're training all of the time, but they're not. I think people think that with me. They think that because I'm fitness director or I've posted about exercise on my Instagram, that I'm always exercising, but I'm not. I generally only ever do 3 or 4 workouts a week. But because I post that, it looks like I'm constantly exercising. So if it's coming from Instagram, remind yourself that it's a highlights reel. But just generally, there's no need to compare yourself to everyone else. Just remind yourself that you should only be thinking about yourself. Everyone is so individual, and what works for someone else probably won't work for you. Like, someone might love yoga, the next person might find that it makes them even more stressed than before they went into the class. So yeah.
You hit the nail on the head there. What works for you? It's a really, really individual approach. The next one is, I'm 25 years old and get very frustrated that I cannot train as much as I used to due to work pressures. I can feel my mental health being impacted. What do you recommend?
I feel like I'm kind of repeating myself, but I feel like this one really, really applies here. So, like I said, I've never done daily workouts, mainly because of work. Like, the thought of trying to fit in a daily workout with work was just impossible when I thought that those workouts needed to be 45 minutes to an hour long. But now I know that 10 to 20 minutes can have a huge difference, and there's time to fit that in. Like, that is a short space of time out of like the 14 hours that you're awake during the day or whatever. 10 to 20 minutes is a short amount of time. So I think if you strive to do that, that is achievable, and that might make you feel better and your mental health will improve with that. In fact, even if you didn't have all of the work commitments that you've got and you didn't have to use as much time to work, 10 to 20 minutes might be better for you anyway if it's mental health that you're struggling with. Because like I've said throughout this whole podcast, overtraining and trying to achieve like a 45 minute to an hour workout so many times a week is just going to make you feel more overwhelmed and stressed anyway. So I would just recommend reducing the durations of those workouts, and probably also the intensity. So if you're doing those daily workouts, just go for something like Pilates, yoga, even a walk. I try and go for a walk every lunchtime when I'm in the office. Obviously weather dependent. If it's pouring down, I'm like, absolutely not, I'm not going outside. But so, for example, this week, I think it was Tuesday, I spent the whole morning, I almost just had this brain fog. It was the time of the month, so that probably was the reason. And then I went for a walk at lunchtime and I came back and I was just so productive for like 3 hours. And before I knew it, it was 5 p.m. and it was time to go home. So I think just think about what exercise actually is. It doesn't need to mean a 45 minute to an hour workout. It can be a walk. It can be 10 minutes of yoga. And I promise you that will help your mental health.
Wonderful, wonderful. And just those little pockets of time that you can find in the day, yeah, can also be a real productivity booster.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you've heard of exercise snacking. It's
I do a workshop on exercise snacking, yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. So we've also got an article in Women's Health, which performs every month about 7-minute workouts. It's quite an old article, but it still brings in traffic every single month. So exercise snacking is basically doing workouts between like 5 and 15 minutes, but doing multiple of them throughout the day to boost your productivity. Because obviously, if you do one in the morning, then yeah, it will give you a productivity boost, but that might not last for the whole day. So yeah, just breaking them up, I think, really.
Let's put a link in the show notes to your exercise snacking on Women's Health. So if anyone wants to get involved with that, there will be a link in the show notes. I've also found as well the pause button on the remote if you're doing a workout at home is an amazing thing. If you can't do it, you can break it up into little chunks during the day, in between your meetings. Mm-hmm. So we're coming to a close now, Bridie. In your role as fitness director at Women's Health, well, you said you've recently been promoted. Has you got a different role now?
I was fitness editor, now fitness director.
Fitness director, okay, Women's Health. What have been the 3 key changes you've seen in the last few years around how we train? And what are your 3 predictions for the future?
Okay, so I think the first change is probably just training for your mental health. I think much of that came from the pandemic, because obviously people recognised how much exercise helped their mental health once it was taken away from them, obviously bar the daily walks that we were permitted. And at Women's Health, I've seen that people are a lot more interested in exercise like yoga and Pilates, as well as things like meditation. The second change I would say is around weightlifting for women and just the fact that it's becoming more popular. So for decades, the rhetoric around weightlifting for women was quite misleading and almost intimidating. I feel like we were basically led to believe that doing it would make us bulky and that it was only for men. But by now, it is by far the top performing fitness topic for women's health on our website, like easily by miles. The third one, kind of touched on this before, but home workouts. Again, I think this stems from the pandemic in that people recognize that you don't need expensive gym memberships or equipment to stay fit. So the challenge that I'm doing now with Pilates, all I've used for the past, I've been doing it for about 3 weeks now, all I've used is a pair of ankle weights and a resistance band, both of which are obviously super cheap. I think the ankle weights were like £15. The resistance band was in a pack of three and it was like, I want to say less than £10. So yeah, they're both super cheap, super effective. On that note though, I do feel like people are spending more money on fitness. Again, I think that comes from the pandemic because people recognize the importance of our health and they are more invested in staying as healthy as they can. So for example, I don't feel like prior to the pandemic, spending like £25 or £30 on a reformer Pilates class would have been like the dumb thing. It wouldn't have been as popular. Whereas now, obviously it's a big trend, but it's like almost a standard for not even people that are on high salaries, but for women that are conscious of their health and are willing to spend out, that's just like the norm. It's almost just like priorities, I think. Priorities have shifted. And then in terms of predictions for the future, one I think that's going to be quite big is aerial yoga. I don't know if you have you ever tried it?
No, my daughter has done it in dance class, but no, I haven't done it myself.
So it's only starting to pick up recently, but I've noticed that a lot of studios are opening and I went to a class and absolutely loved it. It was also really, really challenging though. And I think people often dismiss yoga because it's almost too easy. And I think that puts them off because they think it's not doing them anything for them physically. But aerial yoga promises the mental benefits of traditional yoga, but it's also more physically challenging because you're literally hanging from the ceiling on this like fabric swing. It's hard to explain, but then you do the poses, but they're harder because you've got to stabilize yourself as well. I loved it. It was brilliant. Second prediction, I'd say short workouts. This one's already picking up. So as I mentioned, the 7-minute workout article that we've got performs every month. Exercise snacking is a big trend. I think people just know that long workouts aren't necessary for feeling or even seeing physical results anymore. And as we mentioned, doing shorter, more frequent workouts can actually be more effective because then you get the regular energy or productivity boosts throughout the day rather than just one at the start or the finish. And then last one, this is already a big one, but I feel like it's definitely here to stay, and that's walking. So we did an article on a walking challenge last summer and it had almost 1 million views when it was first published. But we frequently update it and push it back out on our social channels. And every time we do, it still brings in a huge amount of traffic. I will admit I wasn't actually that into walking. I just didn't think it would do that much for me. But now it's like a huge part of my workout routine. I love walking and I always come back feeling like literally a different person. It's just, it's one of the workout forms that doesn't make me feel tired or wired. Little rhyme for you there.
I love a little rhyming everything. But yeah, I think it has been kind of rebranded as walking, hasn't it? Years ago it was for the older generation maybe, but we quite recently had a girls holiday walking, and I had quite a funny photo with us all now with bobble hats and walking boots on compared to 10 years ago when it was bikinis on a girls summer holiday. But I've got to secretly admit that I am an old biddy now and I enjoyed it just as much as my girls partying holidays. So yeah, thank you. So that is some great predictions for the future, and your what you think of those key changes that you've seen in the last few years. So thank you, Bridie. Very, very quickly before we close this, I've got some closing questions. The answer can be true, false, or a super fast explanation. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's go.
Let's go. Okay. Is the one macronutrient that's most important?
False. No.
False. Should we train if we've had a little sleep?
Quick explanation. I feel like this very much depends both on how you're feeling and which type of workout it is you're considering. So if you're super tired, it's probably not wise to do something like weightlifting because you're probably going to be less aware. Your reflexes will be slower, so you might be more likely to injure yourself. But something like Pilates or yoga could give you a boost of energy.
Love it. Love it. Isn't guaranteed that even a credible source recommending a method of training will be optimal for each individual?
No, definitely not. Each type of training is going to have completely different effects on every individual.
Hence why we are both on a mission to empowering people to understand themselves. Does movement improve mental health?
100%, but it can also have a negative effect if you overtrain.
Perfect. Is more the better always the phrase that we should adhere to when training?
Absolutely not.
Brilliant. A big fat false to close the podcast. It just leaves me to say a massive thank you for your time, expertise and energy today. It's been delightful to chat with you. Please do let our listeners know where they can find you, because I'm sure they'd love to hear more about what you do and find out more about you. So where's the best place for them to find you, Brady?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Obviously, on the Women's Health website, in the magazine, we've always got plenty of information about overtraining, just fitness in general. And then also on my personal Instagram, which is just at Bridie Wilkins, I talk a lot about my experience with fitness, overtraining, nutrition, etc., everything.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you very much. Thank you. And thank you all for listening.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. So before you stop listening, I want you to think about how you can make health contagious. Did anything resonate in the podcast? What did you learn that was new? Did you hear something that you thought someone else would love to hear? If so, please share this podcast. Please leave me a review, or please get in touch at anna@leaphealth.co.uk to learn more about how you can improve physical and mental health of individuals and those in the workplace, so that everybody can feel happier and healthier and more productive. Thank you.